This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For someone who never went to law school, Derek Hamilton has a pretty good record. He learned about the law while serving time for a murder that he didn't commit. Derek is well known among so-called jailhouse lawyers. He's filed federal complaints for inhumane treatment of inmates and helped others obtain hearings in addition to fighting his own conviction, which was vacated after 21 years on the inside. He continues to work with prisoners as a paralegal at the Novo Law Firm in Manhattan, and he manages the Novo Innocence Project. We read all about him in a profile called Home Free by the New Yorker reporter at large, Jennifer Gonerman. And Derek Hamilton, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you did have some run-ins with the police when you were younger and served some time for robbery as a teenager. But when did you start learning about the law?
Well, I started learning the law when I was actually a young kid accused of murder. And the system was treating me unfair. And a lawyer that I had by the name of Candace Kurtz kind of told me that I needed to educate myself to understand how I was being railroaded by the system. She gave me two cases. I read them. I was always good in school, so my reading comprehension was always one of my favorite subjects. And amazingly to me, I was able to understand them and have a conversation with this very intelligent lawyer about what was happening to me.
But you were arrested again in 1991, then charged with the murder of Nathaniel Cash. Now, we should mention the detective in this case, Louis Scarsella, who interrogated you. What role did he play in your conviction?
Well, Louis Scarsella was the individual who made a non-witness become a identifying witness, despite the fact that she never saw the murder, and in fact had told his partner, Detective DeLuigia and Scarsella, that she didn't see the crime. He told her that she would stay in jail. He took her to the precinct and said, "You won't get out. You will be charged with the murder if you don't say that you saw Derek commit this horrendous crime."
Mm.
So he was the person who actually had me identified.
He coerced the witness. You did have a solid alibi. This woman was Jewel Smith, Nathaniel Cash's girlfriend, who supposedly named you. But she changed her story a few times.
Under pressure, you do some of the darnest things. You know, we see that people confess every day to murders and crimes they didn't commit. So, I mean, you have a young lady who have two children who's on parole herself, and you got a cop saying, "Look, you're going to jail unless you say this." I know in her defense, I would say that most young women in her age and in her situation from my community would have did the same thing to get out of the precinct.
Mm. Well, you did write your own motion from Rikers Island asking the judge, Edward Rappaport, to set aside the verdict based on Jewel, this woman, telling this PI she had been threatened. Scarsella, of course, denied it, called her reliability into question, though she was actually the key witness in your conviction. What did the judge say?
Well, interestingly, the judge found, because the prosecution witness, Jewel Smith, was unreliable, that I should stay in jail. My issue was that Jewel Smith was always a prosecution witness. We never called to the court on any occasions. In fact, we called the detective to establish that Jews first told him she didn't see the crime. We never called her. So I was amazed how the judge could find that the prosecution witness was incredible, yet blame me and keep me in prison for 21 years based on that.
And meanwhile, you had a couple of witnesses signed affidavits that they knew where you were on the day in question. What happened to their testimony?
Well, originally at trial, my lawyer asked for a continuance in order to procure these witnesses to testify. The judge refused to give us a two-day continuance to secure the witnesses. Some of them were being threatened by a police officer in New Haven, Connecticut, by the name of Billy White, who ultimately was arrested himself for crimes in New Haven, Connecticut. And he was threatening these witnesses and telling them that had they come forth in New York to testify, that they themselves would be locked up, they themselves would be subjected to some reprisal. So, I mean, there was interference by government officials.
Was your own case your first case as a jailhouse lawyer?
Yes, my own case was always my first case. I was successful in previous litigations, and it gave me more confidence. And the more that I learned, working in the law library in the jails, you're going to always have a very many of prisoners, 700 or 800, come into the law library within a year, if not more. And it's your job as a counterman to be able to learn the different variances of their situation and to be able to give them the best advice that you possibly can. So I just studied and studied and studied to try to learn as much as I possibly can to be able to help these guys.
I'm sorry, you say that you had success in your own case, but yet you were still in prison.
Right. You know, in prison, it's successful if you have a hearing.
Mm.
If you can get a judge to call you down and hear you. I mean, there's so many guys that put motions and never get a hearing. In my case, I had four. So, I mean, just to be able to get back before the judge and almost be able to walk out that door is more successful than the average guy ever get.
Mm. Now, it was at Attica. You ran into another inmate who said he was also set up by Scarsella and went to work to refute your conviction. How do you know where to begin? How did you know what to do?
You know, there was always older guys who tutored me. And one of the things that I learned, first and foremost, that you had to know the 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, and 14th Amendment. And excuse me if I bore readers with this, but they said these amendments were the fundamentals of understanding the criminal justice system. So once I learned those, and then I began to read the procedures that must be present whenever a person go to trial, and you look at these procedures to see if any of these things was violated in your trial, and you learn these amendments to see if any of these rights was violated in your trial. So for me, that was the most fundamental place to begin.
Mm. Just having this knowledge, you started advising other prisoners. What kind of cases might you take on?
Well, mostly for me, it was murder cases or violent cases where guys didn't have the light of day, but they was always, you know, family court cases and different things of that nature. You know, before I was able to help anybody, I had to have some success of my own, and I did. And once you're having success in your case and other cases, you get an unlimited number of prisoners that always come in and asking for some assistance. So, I mean, I just took on any case where it was evident that there was a wrongful conviction or a guy was innocent.
Are inmates actually allowed to represent other inmates in court?
There was one guy that was able to do it. His name was Jerry Rosenberg, Jerry the Jew. He was way back when, I think he represented Carmine Gelente, and there's a saying that he got Carmine acquitted, and then the jury seen Jerry get put in handcuffs. I think he was the only one that was able to do it in that particular case. He was the lawyer for, I think, Carmine Gelente.
What a sight that must have been.
Yes, yes.
Jerry the Jew is kind of legendary, I guess. Did you ever meet him?
Me and Jerry was in Windy Correctional Facility together, and we often conferred and often talked. In fact, I got an autographed copy of a book or something he gave me. When Jerry had real sick one time, and he had his heart had failed, and they took him out to the hospital and revived him. And he made an argument to the judge that they had to release him because he was on his second life, that he only had one life sentence, and he died on the operating table. That was the second life. And there was an article about that somewhere, and the judge said, very interesting, Jerry, but you stay in jail. And we used to make fun of stuff like that. Good guy, though. Good guy.
Great story. How were you treated by prisoners and the staff, given all of your grievances and your advocacy for other inmates?
Well, I mean, Attica Correctional Facility is famous for its brutal way they treat prisoners. I did 10 years there. And, you know, if it wasn't for me being a litigant and being able to write the Department of Justice, being able to write the Federal Bureau Investigator, and say, hey, these guys are trying to kill me, and put them on notice that I notified people on the outside that this was happening, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today. So, I mean, on one step, there is, you know, your fear that something terrible is going to happen because you see it happening to prisoners all around you who are not as educated or let's say, fearless as you in that regards to just say, you know what, if I'm going to die, I'm going to let the Federal Bureau Investigator know that, you know, this is what's happening. I'm going to let the Department of Justice know, and I'm going to let the superintendent know that I wrote the Department of Justice this morning and have my people contact them and let them know. But it's always fear. I mean, you see guys being beaten by our correction officers in Attica daily. I mean, you're afraid. You're constantly afraid, no matter how tough you are, that your number is going to play the next day.
We're talking with Derek Hamilton, who, like so many jailhouse lawyers, acquired his legal skills while incarcerated. He was wrongfully convicted and served 21 years for murder. That conviction was vacated, and he now works with other prisoners for the Novo Innocence Project out of the Novo law firm that's in Manhattan. I want to talk about the breakthrough in your case. What happened? What changed things for you, this case involving Troy Davis, if you can go through that for us?
Well, Troy Davis, in 2009, I would say, the United States Supreme Court ruled for the first time in American history that it was unconstitutional, or maybe unconstitutional, to send an innocent man to death row, to kill a man who, but there was evidence, but there was overwhelming evidence he may be innocent. and they remanded the case back down to the Georgia District Court to hold a hearing. To me, that was hope, because I was having the same problem in Kings County, in Brooklyn, that the court would not give me a hearing on an actual innocence claim, which would allow me to present all of my evidence, the alibis, eyewitnesses who saw the crime and identified the true killers. I mean, all of this evidence that was being thrown in the garbage, I would have an opportunity to have judged on its own probative value. And Troy Davis' case seemed to have indicate that I was entitled to that. And armed with that information, I made a motion, and I contacted a lawyer by the name of Jonathan Elstein, and I sent him a copy of the motion in the Troy Davis case and said, hey, you know, I'd like to hire you. I don't have a lot of money. I think I might have sent him $1,500 on my commissary account, which he sent back. And he said, look, I can't take your money. You've made a perfect motion. You've argued everything that you're supposed to argue. He also said he was outraged at the fact that the court had threw all my evidence of innocence in the garbage and that I should go to the media with it.
Can I sum that up in my understanding of the language?
Sure.
That the sworn affidavits from the two witnesses were not accepted because they were not presented at the original trial. Did I get that right?
Right.
Okay,
right.
Do you think I have a career in law now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can definitely... you know, you can definitely be a lawyer at this front.
Okay. So Edelstein suggested that you go to the media. What'd you do?
I organized my family. I asked them to go before the Supreme Court, Kings County, and protest. Have a picket, picket signs and go out there. And they did. And a reporter happened to be coming by from the Daily News of New York named Orrin Yanov, who said he would investigate. After several months of investigating, he wrote a story that says, inmate will be free if they allow his witnesses to testify, some of that nature. It kind of changed the dynamics of everything, because I was going to the parole board at that time, and the parole board had a requirement that you admit to your guilt, that you show remorse in order to get out of prison. So when the article came out and I was arguing with the parole board, it kind of like put me in a position to be able to say, well, look, not only do I know that I was given a raw deal, but so does the Daily News, and so does the, you know, Innocence Project, and so does these other people who wrote things on my behalf. The parole board ultimately released me in 2009, and I was able to get out to society and continue to fight my case.
Hmm. By that time, 21 years served, your children were grown, you did have a new wife,
yes,
a new child. What was that like, being back out in the world after all that time?
Well, let me just go back a little bit. When I was in Auburn Correctional Facility, where I actually got parole from, I already had started a actual innocence team amongst Shabaka Shakur, Danny Rincon, Nelson Cruz, Richard Rosario. I mean, a few of these guys who had overwhelming evidence that they was innocent. And we got a team of guys together, and we said, hey, look, we got to get our families together to organize. We got to kind of like make some noise out in the city, let people know we exist. And that we exist in not just a vacuum, it's more of us than they believe who has been subjected to these type of, you know, atrocities. So ultimately, when I left prison, I left with these guys left behind.
Mm-hmm.
I left with, you know, Shabaka Shakur looking at me that morning when I'm walking out of the door, and both of us was convicted by Scarsella.
Mm-hmm.
We knew exactly what he did to each one of us. And he says, hey, man, don't forget me. So when I left with the voices of Shabaka, Richie, Danny, Nelson, you know, in my ear. So I had to get out, and I had to continue what we already began from behind these walls, and I had to be the biggest advocate for the families of the wrong conviction, because if I didn't, then they would probably give up on their loved ones.
By the time you got out, Louis Scarsello had long been retired. Shabaka Shakur was set up by him. Another, Alvina Jeanette, also set up by him.
Yes.
The New York Times actually ran a story citing your case, going through his long history of alleged misconduct, falsifying confessions, coercing witnesses in several murder cases. The DA said they would review every homicide case that he'd ever worked on. So has there ever been a case against him?
No. Well, there haven't been a case against him. Actually, we learned recently that there's an investigation by the New York City Police Department against him, but there hasn't been any, you know, findings that we know of He hasn't been prosecuted. We believe the statute of limitations is long since ran. We hope that he continues to be Scott Seller in federal depositions, as he's done in all the other trials he went through, and he lies, and he gets convicted in federal court for perjury, is my hope. But he's still living on his pension. He's still living high, and he's still denying that he did anything wrong. And nine people so far has been convictions, murder convictions, have been reversed. It has been proven that non-witnesses, people who were in jail, he used to say that they saw somebody commit a crime. Teresa Gomez, he used in six different murder cases. So, I mean, it's just case after case that shows that he violated rights, and nothing has happened to this man. Nothing. Nothing at all.
Well, how about on your part, a civil lawsuit, a wrongful conviction suit?
We definitely have civil lawsuits filed against him. But, you know, when you're indemnified by the state and the city, when they protect you from having to pay, or we can't go after his pension, it doesn't really bother him that much. It just bothers the city and taxpayers, city and state taxpayers. But, I mean, the laws should be changed when cops like him will be held liable.
Well, so you are continuing to work with people wrongfully convicted or people who, you know, their rights were violated or they didn't get adequate representation. But I'm wondering, Derek Hamilton, why, you know, after you've met so many people who said that they've been screwed over by the criminal justice system, they've been screwed over by the police, you still believe in the power of the law.
Well, you know, I'll tell you that I believe in the power of people. You know, I believe the law in itself is interpreted by people to mean a variety of different things. And you know, you get one bad judge, doesn't mean you should give up. It doesn't mean that you say the system is messed up. That judge is messed up. You know, I mean, I believe in holding people accountable. You know, I believe and you educate people to understand that there's no perfect system of justice. But as people, we can improve it. And if we don't do it, then who are? And I believe if we're not a part of the solution, we're part of the problem. So for me, being a voice of the voiceless, being able to, you know, sit in a courtroom sometime and you know, have a wrongful conviction T-shirt or hat and watch a judge and shake my head when he do something wrong and to maybe call and says, you know, hey, I'm a reporter and what you did today was wrong, just to let him know someone cared. You know, I think if we all did that, we would change the system.
Derek Hamilton, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Derek Hamilton, now a free man after serving 21 years for a murder that he did not commit. He now manages the Novo Innocence Project. That's out of the Novo Law Firm in Manhattan. There's a link to read the profile of him and a follow-up by Jennifer Gonerman from The New Yorker at wordofmouthradio.org.